Nothing In It is made possible by listeners like me. I'm Lydia Daniel, wife to a husband serving in the North Carolina General Assembly. During this pandemic, elected officials truly need the prayers of God's people. I know my fellow listeners are up to the task. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. First Amendment rights and COVID-19 restrictions continue to come into conflict. Assistant Attorney General Eric Dryband will talk to us about what the Department of Justice is doing.
That's ahead today on Legal Docket. Also, the Monday Money Beat July jobs makes three straight months of recovery, but we are not quite halfway back. And reopening offices as an expression of corporate social responsibility. Plus, the World History Book today, a somber anniversary.
An American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
It's Monday, August 10th. This is The World and Everything In It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Now the news. Here's Kent Covington.
With talks over a new coronavirus relief bill largely stalled on Capitol Hill, President Trump over the weekend bypassed Congress and took a series of executive actions. He signed four orders enacting key provisions of a Republican stimulus plan.
First one is on providing a payroll tax holiday to Americans earning less than $100,000 per year.
That presidential memorandum would defer payroll taxes from September 1st through the end of the year, meaning more take-home pay for workers. It would use the same part of the tax code that allowed a delay of the 2019 tax deadline earlier this year. But that, again, is a deferral. It does not guarantee that the taxes won't ever come due, though the White House says that is the aim. Another order would renew a boost to jobless benefits in the amount of about $400 per week. The $600 a week federal boost expired on August 1st. The other orders are aimed at protecting renters from eviction and pausing student loan payments. But Democratic leaders are blasting the move, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The president's executive orders, described in one word, could be paltry. In three words, unworkable, weak, and far too narrow.
And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called them, quote, an illusion. Others have questioned whether the president is overstepping his authority, but the White House says it is confident that the orders will stand up to any legal challenges. In Beirut, protesters are unleashing their fury over last week's massive explosion. Demonstrators flooded streets ripped apart by the blasts and stormed government buildings over the weekend. They clashed with security forces who responded by firing tear gas and rubber bullets. Dozens were injured and one police officer was killed in the uprising. The massive explosion, which followed a smaller blast, devastated the city's port, killed more than 150 people and injured some 6,000 others. It also left hundreds of thousands homeless and caused an estimated $10 to $15 billion of damage. Aya Mazoub of Human Rights Watch told Sky News.
They are enraged that so many politicians and public officials were aware that more than 2,700 tons of explosive material was just left in the port for years without any safety measures.
The disaster has taken popular anger in Lebanon to a new level in a country already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. Defense Secretary Mark Esper over the weekend announced that the Pentagon plans to cut the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan to less than 5,000 by the end of November.
Right now, we think that we can do all the core missions, first and foremost being ensure the United States is not threatened by terrorists coming out of Afghanistan. We can do those at a lower level.
The Trump administration has pursued drawdowns of military forces across the Middle East, most notably in Afghanistan and Syria. The Pentagon has already pulled 3,000 troops out of Afghanistan this year. About 8,500 American troops remain in the country. Liberty University President Jerry Falwell Jr. will take an indefinite leave of absence from the school after posting a controversial photo on Instagram. The image, which he later deleted, showed him with his arm around his wife's pregnant assistant, both of them with their midsections exposed and their pants partially unzipped. Falwell said they were posing just for fun, but admitted that he should not have posted it. The photo was the latest in a series of controversies surrounding Falwell. At the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, experts and Liberty faculty and students criticized Falwell for continuing to have classes on campus, though no cases were reported through the end of the school year. And in May, he tweeted an image of a mask with the racially offensive photo. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, COVID-19 restrictions and the First Amendment, plus Kim Henderson on translating spouse speak. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Monday morning and a brand new work week for The World and Everything in It. Today is the 10th of August, 2020. Good morning to you. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Well, today on Legal Docket, the economic shutdowns and conflicts with religious freedom. Now, with COVID-19 still an issue among us, some states continue with strict limits on gathering sizes in all kinds of contexts, from elevators to restaurants and bars to casinos to churches. But officials have not evenly applied the regulations or grappled with First Amendment protections in the U.S. Constitution. And that is causing problems. Late last month, a split U.S. Supreme Court rejected a request from a church that sought to block enforcement of restrictions that church leaders considered discriminatory. Calvary Chapel, Dayton Valley in Nevada, argued that casinos, restaurants, and amusement parks had more generous capacity limits than churches did. The Supreme Court gave no explanation, and that's not unusual for emergency applications.
Right, and the court also rejected a similar plea from a church in California in May by that same 5-4 ruling. Now, these skirmishes are going on all around the country. The pastor of Grace Community Church, John MacArthur, has defied California's regulations by conducting church services that include singing, and that carries a potential fine of $1,000 per day. MacArthur believes that government is to protect civic order, but it cannot dictate doctrine, practice, or polity of the church. Here's how he put it in a video message last updated on Thursday.
We've gotten affirmation from some pretty significant places. Some of the people that are significant in Washington want to come along and help us, some people with legal expertise on the Constitution. And so we don't know what's going to come in the future, but one thing we can promise you, we're having church at Grace every Sunday.
Joining us now to talk about this is U.S. Assistant Attorney General Eric Dryband. He leads the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice. AAG Dryband, welcome.
Well, Mary, thank you for having me.
The Civil Rights Division outlined some of the unequal treatment houses of worship have faced during the pandemic in a recent DOJ publication. I just mentioned a couple of those. Can you talk about what else you're seeing on this front?
Well, Mary, we've seen quite a bit of activity in response to the COVID-19 pandemic that several state and local governments have taken very aggressive action to try to address the pandemic by shutting down houses of worship, as well as other parts of our society and our economy, particularly when the shutdown orders happened in March and April, but continuing even to present day. The first case that we saw involving what we thought and still think raised First Amendment protections for houses of worship was a case out of the state of Mississippi, and we filed papers in federal court there to protect the right of the people there to exercise their religion, and fortunately we were successful. And that was back in early April, and we've continued on ever since.
Well, I know back in April, Attorney General William Barr released a statement on religious practice and social distancing, and around the same time, you wrote an op-ed about this. What else is the Justice Department doing to ensure houses of worship even know what their rights are?
Well, you're right. I did write an op-ed and made clear back in early April that there is no pandemic exception to the Bill of Rights. There is no exception in the First Amendment protections for religious freedom, for the right of all of us to exercise our religion. That continues during the pandemic, and that state and local governments cannot and should not infringe upon that. We have continued both publicly and otherwise to take action in federal court proceedings at every level of the federal courts when necessary to protect religious freedom. We've also spoken publicly and issued public statements in defense of religious freedom, and we will continue to do so.
At the outset, I mentioned one California megachurch, Grace Community Church, has met over the last few weeks despite state orders not to. So far, authorities have not taken action against the church except to send a cease and desist letter. But what if the state does take more action against the church? Would the Justice Department intervene on its behalf?
Mary, I can't comment on pending matters that are in front of the Justice Department, but here's what I can say, is that it is certainly the case on the one hand that state and local governments have very broad authority to protect public health and safety, but on the other hand, state and local governments cannot violate the free exercise of religion protections contained in the First Amendment to the Constitution. And so what we do is, as a general matter, is we look at what state and local governments are doing. We have a team of investigators and lawyers who are looking at this, who are scrutinizing everything that state and local governments are doing across the country, including in California. And when appropriate, we are taking action in court. And if there is some kind of discrimination going on against, say, a house of worship or people who are trying to exercise their religion, then we have taken action and we will continue to do that. And I know, for example, in California in particular, we became aware of concerns in May of this year, just about 2.5-3 months ago. And I sent a letter to Governor Newsom, along with all four United States attorneys in California, expressing our concerns about the infringement of religious freedom and places of worship and their right to worship and be treated equally, along with other non-religious institutions. And so, for example, Mary, we highlighted to Governor Newsom and expressed concerns about the protections, the fact that restaurants, shopping malls, and offices could have gatherings, but houses of worship could not. We thought, and still do, that that kind of limit on houses of worship may run afoul of the First Amendment to the Constitution. Fortunately, Governor Newsom and his team agreed with us, and so 6 days after we sent our letter, Governor Newsom modified his standards in California to permit greater attendance of places of worship. And so that's all public, but mayors, governors, public health commissioners throughout the country should be on notice that we are and will continue, as I say, to scrutinize what they are doing and to take action where appropriate.
You know, you mentioned discrimination, unequal treatment. These are legal terms. I wonder, what do you see as the root cause of such unequal treatment? Is it hostility toward religion? Is it ignorance of the law? Something else? What do you think?
Well, I can't say for sure, Mary, what motivates some people. I mean, I think there have been times when, you know, some people in our country are less supportive of religious freedom than others. That's certainly true. But from our point of view, it doesn't really matter what motivates these people, and that is state and local governments. If they violate the First Amendment, we don't have to prove that they did so because they are hostile to religion. All we have to do is demonstrate that what they are doing or what they are imposing on houses of worship or people of faith is inconsistent with what they are doing to other similar kinds of people or institutions. And if we can show that, whether they don't understand the law or whether they don't like houses of worship doesn't matter. And so that's the approach we've taken. We have seen instances where public officials throughout the country at various times have favored non-religious gatherings in a significant way over religious gatherings. And for whatever their motives are, that simply is not permitted by the Constitution of the United States, and the Justice Department will not tolerate that kind of action.
Final question here. We have a lot of pastors and churchgoers in our audience. If they're considering meeting again, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think, you know, each situation is different. Different communities are facing different challenges with addressing the pandemic and the, you know, a highly contagious, deadly virus that is the so-called novel coronavirus. So I think they need to take account of, for themselves and their communities, their health and safety, and of them and their families. It's certainly religious worship is important. It's important to me personally, but it's also important to the Justice Department as a matter of protecting the rights that we have in this country. They should think about what is the legal status of matters in their town or their state in terms of what their options are, and make the best judgment they can. But it's a difficult time for all of us in our country and across the world, really. But in a country that it was founded upon people fleeing oppression by governments and tyranny against religious faith, it is critically important, in my view, that we continue here in this country to protect the right of all people to worship as they deem appropriate, within, of course, respectful limits of health and safety, right, to the extent possible.
You speak in our language. Eric Dryband is the U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mary.
Additional support comes from ConquerSeries.com, helping more than 1 million men break free from pornography. Freedom today at ConquerSeries.com.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, the Monday Money Beat.
Well, more Americans went back to work in July, and that 1.8 million of our countrymen did so beat economists' expectations of a number much smaller. The number builds on net job growth in June and even May. So for 3 months, more than 9 million jobs have returned. Problem is, 22 million went away since COVID-19 arrived and the lockdowns began. In a sense, you could say the job losses suffered in late March and all of April wiped out 10 years of job creation. So of the 22 million jobs lost, we now have 9 million back online, and that is 40% of the loss made up. So still quite a long way to go, but a meaningful start. Here now to talk about it is financial analyst and advisor David Bahnsen. David, hope you're well. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you, Nick?
Yeah, doing great. Thanks. Let's talk July jobs, David. I know the number beat what labor economists had thought, but I was frankly cheering for more than that number. But still, stands to reason with all of the re-lockdowns, slightly better is better than worse. How do you see it?
Yeah, it's actually a lot better than was expected. I think that the more optimistic projections were closer to 1.4. And I also agree with you that with the sort of lockdown endeavors at a kind of half rate or three quarters rate that you might have seen in some states in the Sun Belt or the South. So I think that the July number, they're all in the category that we've talked about for so long, which is less bad than expected. And that is, of course, still bad. But I want to go back first, Nick, to something you said when you were setting this up about 10 years of job growth wiped away. I think that if you put in a spreadsheet the number of jobs that were created in 10 years, and then in a spreadsheet the number of jobs that went away, that may be true, but it isn't true in any practical or real sense as long as those job losses are at 70 or 80% categorized as temporary. Now, of course, the problem is, A, temporary job losses, people aren't getting paid, and that's awful and tragic for them, and B, they may be wrong that it's temporary. Some of those job losses may be start off as temporary, become permanent. But I think that to try to frame it as a comparison to the 10 years of job growth, there's a real apples to oranges thing that is going on there. What is relevant and what is true is that the job losses have been severe and they've been awful for those people. But what I think we continue to learn as more and more data comes out is how incredibly true some of my theories have been throughout this. That makes it, in my mind, from a humanitarian standpoint, worse, not better, but economically is still important to sort of distinguish. So you have this situation that becomes a little bit less profound in its economic impact, but I think more profound in the human suffering because they're people that can least afford to be without work and without income.
And you know, David, speaking of that, you wrote a letter to fellow financial professionals in New York City urging them to get back into the city. And you made the point that wealthy white-collar workers are doing just fine working from home, but all the people around them, service workers, bars, restaurants, sandwich shops, dry cleaners, they're hurting because of all of that working from home. And you argued that, yeah, we're continuing to thrive, but by not reporting to work in Manhattan, we're hurting people who really can't afford to be hurt right now. Have you gotten any kind of response?
I have. And first, there was quite a bit of response. But it isn't that the humanitarian approach was like an angle per se, right? You and I really believe it. It really is the essence of economics, that there is an impact that goes beyond just what you can immediately see. And that in this case, there's sort of invisible hand dynamics that are not hurting entrenched and powerful people. They're hurting people that are downstream, that I have heard for years from corporate America how hugely important social responsibility now is to them. And they do a big support for BLM, and they do a big support for LGBT, and God forbid that they do anything in the fossil fuel industry. So they have their social corporate responsibility goals very well articulated, and there is some of the most profound proclamation of their virtue that I have ever seen. Well, here's a chance to do something incredibly socially responsible, to have the people that can safely return to work. It makes their own business even more optimal and efficient. But even apart from that, because they're, as you said, they're certainly surviving without it, they have a chance to have this impact throughout the others in the community and the ecosystem that is urban America. And they need to, I think, begin to implement that after Labor Day, not waiting all the way till the end of the year. And I'm very hopeful that at least some will respond to that call, because I think it's a moral call and of course, very good for the economy as well.
Now, we talked about the July employment report. Let's talk about more current affairs, and that would be weekly claims for unemployment benefits and continuing jobless benefits. So 1.2 million new claims last week, continuing claims of just over 16 million. Probably well at this point to remind the listener that before COVID, continuing claims were in the neighborhood of 2 million. Now we're talking about 16 million. So again, to your point, we are talking eight times that number. It's just unbelievable on a human scale. And let me add one other thing. The $600 per week unemployment bonus, I think, fully expired. Is it too early to say that that's having an impact?
Yeah, it's definitely too early because the data wouldn't even be wiped in yet. But what you saw was the initial jobless claims drop to the lowest number since COVID began, but about closer to 1.1 million, but still well over a million, still very high. And then the continuous claims, which at one point were at 25 million, are now down to 16. So then you take the data and you look at the monthly jobs report. And we have a labor force of about 164 million people in a population of 330 million. And obviously there's plenty of kids and elderly and others that can't work. I still think 164 million in our labor force is way too low. But either way, roughly 10.1% unemployment rate, that matches up. You know, we have a few confirming data points that suggest that there's somewhere between 15 and 18 million unemployed people in the country. And there's some, and there's more underemployed as well that maybe are working part-time that want full-time. But that number came down this month too. So I don't have an exception to it, Nick. All the data points are less bad than expected and still bad.
All right, David Bahnsen, financial analyst and advisor. Always great to talk with you. We'll catch you again next week. Thanks, David.
Thanks so much, Nick.
Today is Monday, August 10th. You're listening to World Radio, and we're really glad you are. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, the World History Book. Today, the five-year anniversary of a deadly explosion in China. Plus, 75 years ago, the U.S. drops two atomic bombs on Japan. But first, 85 years ago, the U.S. government commits to a financial safety net for the elderly. Here's Paul Butler.
We begin today on August 14th, 1935.
Today, a hope of many years' standing is in large part fulfilled.
Surrounded by his advisors, his wife, and political leaders, Franklin D. Roosevelt signs into law his New Deal domestic program, known as the Social Security Act.
This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens.
The first 2 years of Roosevelt's presidency were marked with banking and employment reforms in hopes of promoting relief and recovery due to the Great Depression. Beginning in 1935, Roosevelt turns his attention to social problems. He unveils a handful of more controversial programs, including the Social Security Act.
We can never insure 100% of the population against 100% of the hazards and vicissitudes of life, but we have tried to frame a law which will give some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family against the loss of a job and against poverty-stricken old age.
The act withstands two Supreme Court challenges and over the next 30 years is amended 10 times by the U.S. government, dramatically growing the scope and level of benefits.
It seems to me that if the Senate and the House of Representatives in this long and arduous session had done nothing more than pass this security bill, the session would be regarded as historic for all time.
According to the Social Security Administration 2020 annual report, the yearly cost of the 85-year-old program now officially exceeds its income. The board projects that that will be the case indefinitely. The latest report also finds that Social Security will empty its trust funds by 2034, though the board assures Americans that doesn't mean Social Security dies at that point. Unless Congress does something about it, however, Social Security will have to live within its means by lowering benefits to about 80% of current levels. Next, August 6, 1945.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
The detonation levels most of the Japanese port city. 70,000 people are instantly killed, with tens of thousands dying in the months and years following due to radiation poisoning and burns.
The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet.
Truman kept that promise. 3 days later, U.S. forces dropped a second nuclear bomb on Nagasaki, killing another 30 to 40,000.
It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth.
On August 12, 1945, after 3 days of debate, the Japanese emperor declares his intention to surrender. He makes that official at the signing ceremony 3 weeks later on the deck of the battleship, the USS Missouri. And finally, 5 years ago this week, on August 12, 2015.
This morning, horrific video pouring in of a series of catastrophic explosions.
A series of explosions rocked the port of Tianjin in China.
The explosions felt miles away.
The first fireball lights up the night sky at about 11 p.m. Residents in the neighboring apartment complex begin filming the conflagration.
I think that might be a gas station.
Whoa!
Then a second, much larger explosion as nearly 800 tons of ammonia nitrate ignite. The blast kills more than 50 people. It levels buildings, shatters windows, and sets hundreds of fires.
2 days on and the fire is still burning amid containers holding an unknown mix of dangerous, highly toxic chemicals.
The fires burn uncontrollably throughout the weekend, setting off 8 additional explosions. 104 firefighters die battling the flames.
Well, the site where the explosion took place is just a few meters, 100 meters or so in that direction. And what you can see behind me here are the remains of a dormitory for migrant workers.
China's Communist Party officials censor nearly all media coverage within the country. Social media posts are quickly deleted, and international coverage is blocked. In the end, nearly 50 local officials and warehouse staff serve jail terms for unsafe practices and unlawful handling of toxic materials. That's this week's World History Book. I'm Paul Butler.
Today is Monday, August 10th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Here is world commentator Kim Henderson on the trials of marital communication.
I have this sister-in-law who can hold her own in four languages. She would insist it's really only three. One's a different dialect of her native Chinese. But I know better. After all, it's those tonal languages that linguists say are the hardest to learn. The kind in which a single syllable can have several different meanings based on the rising and falling pitch of the speaker's voice. For example, a simple two letters, M-A, can be pronounced as ma, 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 with each sound having a different meaning. Mix them up and you could end up saying, the speckled mother scolds the horse. Easy peasy, right? Evidently, the translation difficulty works both ways. Here's a message I recently received from an eBay seller based in the Eastern Hemisphere. Dear Henderson, hope everything goes fine with you. This email probably disturbed you, but I'm concerning about your package status. As the shipping is free and realize it's international mail post send by economy option, hope you could really understand this. When you are receiving good conditional, leave us positive feedback in real five. Star, 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 stars. Now, that's about as funny as some of the research papers I've graded. But not all tonal language issues are humorous. Case in point, the tonal language used by the most curious of all people groups, spouses. In no subsection of the human species is the use of rising and falling pitch more pronounced, or more readily translatable, than among husbands and wives. Here's a transcript from a closet conversation between two spouses who shall remain nameless. Each time, it's the same sentence, exact same words. But notice the importance of accent marks in spouse speak. You want me to wear my blue jacket? Translation, it doesn't say business casual on the invitation. Or this one, you want me to wear my blue jacket? Translation, I prefer the brown tweed. And lastly, you want me to wear my blue jacket. Translation, you owe me. That's why in closets and other tight spots, couples really have to watch it. The derogatory use of diphthongs or whatever else is in their linguistic arsenal, because miscommunication, the mother of all translation barriers, will come right on in without even knocking. So in the lingo of lovers, as in overseas eBay correspondence, it's all about semantics. Who knows, maybe that Rosetta Stone company will eventually put spouse speak and eBayese in its teaching lineup along with Farsi. Until then, blue jacket wearers and online buyers will simply have to keep struggling. Blame it on that incident at Babel. And while you're at it, watch your tone. I'm Kim Henderson.
Tomorrow, with the COVID-19 restrictions in place, prison chaplains are having a difficult time caring for inmates. We'll find out how that's affecting men and women who desperately need the gospel. And we will talk about the stalemate over stimulus legislation in Washington. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichert. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Bible reminds us that neither death nor life nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Hey, it is a big day today. Happy birthday to our founder, Joel Bells.
Happy birthday!